National Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we consider what the results of the New Hampshire contest mean for the presidential race. An expert speaks with us about the conflict in Syria. We'll hear from an exclusive interview with the Iraqi ambassador on ISIS. And there's exciting news for superstar Mariah Carey.
She is, without question, the ultimate diva in music. She's won 5 Grammys, 19 music awards. She was the artist of the millennium.
Coming up right here on The Voice of America. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and New York billionaire businessman Donald Trump emerged as the Democratic and Republican winners in the New Hampshire state presidential primary election. Sanders handily defeated former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton 60-38% and said his victory sent a message to the nation.
Together, we have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California. And that is that the government of our great country belongs to all of the people and not just a handful of wealthy campaign contributors and their super PACs.
Trump bested the other Republican hopefuls, taking 35% of the vote, with Ohio Governor John Kasich coming in a distant second at 16%. Trump, speaking to his supporters, took aim at Sanders for wanting to give the country away, and while congratulating him, said he won't let that happen again.
We are going to make America great again, but we're going to do it the old-fashioned way. We're going to beat China, Japan. We're going to beat Mexico at trade. We're going to beat all of these countries that are taking so much of our money away from us on a daily basis. It's not going to happen anymore. We are going to do something so good and so fast and so strong, and the world is going to respect us again. Believe me.
VOA senior national affairs correspondent Jim Malone has been in New Hampshire reporting on the race for the White House, and he joins us now on the line. Welcome once again to the show, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
Say, what does this balloting mean for all of the candidates in the Republican camp?
Well, it means a couple of things. Number one, Donald Trump is for real. But can he win a majority in the Republican Party? That question is outstanding. Number two, John Kasich is the surprise sort of new star coming out of New Hampshire. But the problem for Kasich is, can he win in the southern states, which now get to vote in the Republican primaries? That's going to be a big challenge. Number three, Jeb Bush is alive. He's going to be a contender. He's going to fight, especially in South Carolina. But number four, Marco Rubio has slipped, basically because of his poor debate performance. And so the Republican field is a bit of a jumble right now. And let's not forget Ted Cruz, who did third place in New Hampshire, won in Iowa, and has now set himself up to do well in the South. So heading south, it looks like a pretty big battle, especially between Trump and Cruz.
Well, what about the Democrats? Is this going to continue to be a very close two-horse race?
I think so, and not only close, but I think a little tense, a little testy, and I think the Democrats are going to do a little soul-searching here. I don't think anybody expected Hillary Clinton to find herself in this position. Look, looking at the exit polls, I mean, she lost to Bernie Sanders among women voters. That's going to be a big red flag. The Clinton team believes that when they go south, as they're going to South Carolina and then toward Nevada, that they'll do better, especially with minority voters, especially African-American voters. That's going to be their firewall in South Carolina. But Sanders has the momentum. The challenge for him is, can he make himself into a sort of viable national candidate? And can he, you know, play off the momentum of New Hampshire, where the constituency was very much in his favor, to do well in some other states where Clinton will be favored?
Well, take a deep breath and tell me, what is the feeling there now in New Hampshire now that the primary is finally over?
Well, this is a great state to come and watch. It's like a microcosm of democracy. Everything's close together. The people are used to the attention. They know this, the world spotlight is on them for whatever period leading up to the primary. It's really a lot of fun to cover it. And the great thing about New Hampshire voters is they get to see all the candidates. They're like choosy shoppers. They go to a lot of rallies, And many of them do not decide until the last minute. And I think the last minute beneficiaries on Tuesday, definitely beginning with John Kasich, were welcomed by New Hampshire voters. And he's the kind of candidate that does well up here, sort of individualistic, libertarian, moderate. But now we move into other parts of the country, and it's going to be a different set of voting constituencies.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, for your insight today and in the past couple of days while we've been going through this.
Always a pleasure.
There we go. With a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story is social media reporter Andrew Palchewski, and welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me. Well, it's the Wednesday morning quarterbacking after the New Hampshire primary, and a lot of people pointing out some very interesting things on social media, as they often do. They kind of drill down into the minutiae and give us a look at things we wouldn't necessarily think about or look at. For example, the fact that Bernie Sanders won over Hillary Clinton over 20 points ahead of her, about 60% to 40%. But the way the delegates are awarded, Bernie Sanders got 13 delegates, Hillary Clinton got 15. So even though she lost by 20 points, she actually got more delegates because of the way that the nominating process works in the Democratic Party. So a lot of people questioning that on social media, wondering how that's the case. You also have a lot of people talking about John Kasich, who finished second place, a Republican governor of Ohio, saying, who is this guy? Why has he come out of nowhere all of a sudden? So it's giving him a lot of good recognition on social media, especially. His supporters are able to share information about him. People are able to find information about him. And Bernie Sanders had an interesting moment last night. Prior to going on stage and declaring victory, he was out shooting hoops with his family. He was in a school gymnasium in New Hampshire, just shooting a basketball, having a good time. So a lot of people sharing that video and saying he's just a regular guy, just hanging out with his family.
That's fun. But you mentioned, right, because we have to go in a moment or so, what about this something about Super Bowl still hanging around?
Still, with the halftime show, Carlos Santana, the amazing guitarist, has come out and said that he wishes the Super Bowl would have included live music and included bands from the San Francisco area where the Super Bowl was held. So bands like the Eagles and Metallica. A lot of people pointing out that in Super Bowl 37, in the pregame show, Beyonce and Carlos Santana performed together, and it was an amazing performance. So they said maybe Carlos Santana should have performed with Beyonce and Bruno Mars. Maybe we would have had a better halftime show than Coldplay gave us.
Well, I think it was a pretty good halftime show, either way you go.
Yeah, it was. Opinions were mixed, but overall, I still can't sing that well. So.
Okay, thank you, Andrew, for coming by.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A multidisciplinary team of researchers that included scientists and historians have discovered a new extraordinary and extended period of cooling in the Northern Hemisphere between 536 to about 660 AD. Called the Late Antique Little Ice Age, the researchers found that it appears to play a role in one of the most tempestuous periods of world history. Michael McCormick, a professor of medieval history at Harvard University, says that the cooling period was good for some and not so good for others.
You have the Roman Empire undergoing very serious stress, and then starting in the 630s and 640s to the extraordinary overnight growth of the Arab early Islamic empire.
The researchers were able to reconstruct summer temperatures over the past 2,000 years by studying tree rings. The climate data was then compared with a historical record of the time. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United Nations has expressed growing alarm that Syria's Russian-backed offensive in the north could encircle the divided of Aleppo. It threatens to cut off humanitarian aid to hundreds of thousands of civilians, creating yet another mass exodus of refugees to countries like Turkey, which is already temporary home to 2.5 million Syrians. Russian airstrikes have been pounding opposition forces in the Aleppo area, causing growing concern about the civilian death toll. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, meanwhile, said Moscow has presented Washington with new proposals to end the conflict and dismissed criticism Russian airstrikes contributed to the collapse of the latest peace talks. He said Turkey is fueling the conflict by providing militants with weapons and supplies. Syrian analyst David Lesh of Trinity College in Texas told VOA's Victor Beatty he fears Damascus and its Russian and Iranian backers are going to resort to the same tactics it has used elsewhere in the five-year conflict as it surrounds Aleppo.
where they bludgeoned the population that remains in the city, and therefore they reluctantly accept ceasefires by default, in essence. That will mean further misery for those Syrian civilians and others who are stuck in Aleppo and aren't able to get out and try to escape as refugees to someplace else in Syria or to Turkey. But I think that from the regime perspective, they think that this sort of brutal tactic has worked in the past and will work now, and that most Syrian civilians, as they have in some other places, will accept ultimately the regime simply because it will end the fighting if there is one victor. I think that's what the Russian plan has been all along, is that make it basically a fait accompli. That all depends, I think, on whether or not Saudi Arabia and Turkey, the traditional backers of the Syrian opposition groups that are now under fire, want to up the ante and provide the sort of support materiel that will allow them to maintain the fight. You know, most sustainable political settlements are the result of a rough symmetry between the parties at the table. And right now, that does not exist. So the question is, will the elements of the Syrian opposition, so weakened and so bludgeoned and so weary of war, come to the table just to end it, or will they refuse to come in such a weakened condition with the hope that they will be able to improve their situation in the near future?
Are you concerned that Turkey could actually invoke the NATO charter, bring NATO into the situation, or join with Gulf Arab states to possibly intervene? Saudi Arabia indicating it's prepared to send special forces into Syria.
I think that that's all bluster. I think the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates have said it as well. I just do not think that's within their capabilities, certainly with the Saudis, with regard to the fact that they're so entrenched in the Yemen war right now. I think the Turks are very serious about the situation in northern Syria, particularly if the Kurdish enclaves unite. There's a Kurdish enclave in the extreme northwest of Syria, Afrin, and there's the Rojava area in the central north and northeastern part of Syria. If they connect, which they very well could, that would act as a Kurdish buffer state between Turkey and the rest of Syria. Now, the Turks are very concerned about this. They said this is a red line, but the problem from the Turkish perspective is that there are Russians there now.
David Lesh says while the Russian strategy to keep President Bashar al-Assad in power may succeed, it may also help achieve the primary Western objective in Syria, namely to defeat the Islamic State. He says that is what Damascus would seek to do once it bludgeons the rest of the opposition. Coming up on International Edition, the Iraqi ambassador speaks about ISIS, and singer Mariah Carey is getting hitched. The U.S. is firm on not sending ground troops into Iraq to fight Daesh or ISIS. Iraqi Ambassador Luke Benfeli told VOA Iraq prefers to use its own forces to uproot the terrorist organization from its territories and just needs international coalition support. We get more details in the first part of an interview with an ambassador conducted by International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawi.
The United States is still insisting not to send ground troops to Iraq and just instead sending advisors and some special forces from the United States. Is that enough to uproot Daesh from Iraq?
We have not asked for the United States for troops, and there was a clear agreement from both capitals that the fight should be led by Iraqis. We need support in relation to ammunition, training, intelligence sharing, and so on, but we don't need boots on the ground or combat forces. This is an Iraqi fight, and to that effect, we have a full agreement with the administration. In fact, even when other countries have offered us, we have said no, because this has to be led by Iraqis.
So far, is Iraq satisfied with the kind of help it's getting from the coalition?
Well, as you know, Daesh is, we don't have what you might call a pure conventional war, nor it's an asymmetrical, it's a mix. So to that effect, we need to have a close collaboration. We need other countries to have a clear sense of urgency, as we do have. So when you say that we're satisfied, I think the only satisfaction we will get is when we get rid of ISIS once and for all. We still need further support. We have other challenges which may be hindering our military challenge, which is to do with the economy. economical challenge. We also have to make sure that the regional politics support it as well.
Who will assist the Iraqis on the ground to get rid of Daesh?
Currently, the central government is leading it with collaborations from PMUs, with collaborations from local tribes, with collaborations of the Peshmerga forces, and also those political parties who have focus on working with the central government in making sure that the politics is not party to this discussion. So we need to get our politics, our economy to support our military, and certainly we need international cooperation to support our military on the ground.
Saudi Arabia is offering to send troops to fight Daesh. Would Iraq be open to invite Saudi troops, United Arab Emirates?
We have said no to the United States troops. We have said no to the Iranian troops, who both have been working with us closely in this fight. Saudi Arabia and other countries are more than welcome to advise us and tell us what they can offer. We have not had these formal requests from them, so until we do that, we cannot take into consideration. But from our side, as a basis, we have said we prefer not to have regional troops on the ground. We would like to have international advisors, because we think that our regional neighbors will not come in just without a baggage of a type. We need to make sure that the support they provide is to be effective and expedite the process on the ground. Bringing them in might make it more complicated, and what we need the Iraqis to lead this fight. So help us with the politics, help us with economical support, but as far as troops on the ground, we would rather be led by Iraqis for Iraqis.
Iraqi Ambassador Luqman Feili speaking in an exclusive interview with International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawi. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A Tibetan singing bowl is played for a class at Unplugged Meditation in Los Angeles. This class is at a new so-called brain gym, a place for people to relieve stress in a fitness environment. Owner Suze Yalof-Schwartz says it was her mission to start a place that makes it easy for people to meditate.
Why is there no tri-bar of meditation where you kind of walk in feeling icky and walk out feeling great, and you learn it and you get it and you go?
Being stressed is not very fun.
People who meditate say the practice helps them to relax, focus, and even sleep better.
For me, it's helped me calm down a lot. It's relieved a lot of my stress. It's made all of my relationships better.
2014 research from Johns Hopkins University found moderate evidence that continued meditation does improve symptoms of anxiety, depression, and pain. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Border Crossing's Larry London has joined me here in the studio with news from the music world. And today we're going to talk about super duper star Mariah Carey, who Larry tells me everybody knows. Everybody knows that, Mariah.
There isn't a person on the planet other than you, Susan, who doesn't know Mariah Carey. 200 million albums sold. She is, without question, the ultimate diva in music. She's won 5 Grammys, 19 music awards. She was the artist of the millennium. She had a number one hit in every year of the 90s, only artist to do that. So, she's right up there with the creme de la creme.
So what's she up to now?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Uh-huh. There's some big news about Mariah Carey. It's not music news.
Oh.
I don't have music news today because Mariah hasn't had an album out for a little bit. You know, she put out an album in 2014, and that was her last new album, although I understand there's a plan for her to work on a new album sometime this year. But she's not in a rush because she's got a Las Vegas residency. She's performing regularly in a hotel casino in Las Vegas.
That's like a good gig.
That's what everybody seems to be doing now. Jennifer Lopez, Celine Dion's been doing it for years, and so now Mariah's got her regular thing going on. But here's the news that's very exciting for Mariah Carey. She just got engaged.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, that's right, Susan. It's her third marriage. She was once married to Tommy Mottola, who ran Sony Music at the time, and that marriage lasted a few years. Then she married Nick Cannon. They have 2 children together, Monroe and Moroccan, and got divorced last year. And now Mariah has moved down and found new love with a billionaire whose name is James Packer.
And the ring?
Oh, of course, and the ring, the 35-carat
diamond ring.
Ooh, she can use that in her show to light the stage.
She does, as a matter of fact. It was a newspaper story in Las Vegas that the diamond ring stole the show and was distracting everybody.
Ooh, well, let's listen to one of her songs, Always Be My Baby. Nice to have you stop by the studio.
Thank you, Susan. It's always a pleasure to be here in the studio.
I ain't gonna cry, no, and I won't beg you to stay. If you're determined to leave, boy, I will not stand in your way.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a rising tide of religious persecution emerging worldwide, and it disproportionately threatens religious minority groups. This threat touches Christians in the Middle East, Yazidis in Iraq, Baha'is in Iran, Hindus in Pakistan and Bangladesh, Muslims in India, or Sunni Muslims in Shia areas, or vice versa. The threat, said Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South and Central Asia, Knox Thames, is clear and present. Terrorists and non-state actors such as ISIL, the Nusra Front, and Al-Qaeda are some of the worst persecutors of religious minorities. But individual attackers have also perpetrated acts of violence against religious minorities. And unfortunately, in far too many places, governments continue to limit the exercise of religious freedoms. Protecting and promoting the universal right to freedom of religion is central to American foreign policy. Not only is it the right thing to do, said Special Advisor Knox, it is a smart thing to do as it plays a major role in contributing to more stable, progressive, and dynamic societies. Wherever people face religious persecution, the United States is at work finding ways to help. For example, the U.S. pressures governments to enact reforms so that religious minorities are able to freely practice their faith. Militarily, through airstrikes, the U.S. is providing protection for minority religions to remain in their ancestral homeland. The U.S. continues to provide humanitarian assistance to Syrians and Iraqis, including refugees and displaced populations, and supports resettlement for those who cannot safely return home. The U.S. is encouraging countries in the Middle East to support, through education, respect for human rights and religious freedom. Governments in the region are also being urged to take steps to protect religious minorities during holy days and religious gatherings. The United States, said President Barack Obama, will continue to work with a broad coalition against those who have subjected religious minorities to unspeakable violence and persecution. All people deserve the fundamental dignity of practicing their faith free from fear, intimidation, and violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.